Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Michael Bell and Leonard Cady, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
Mark, thank you for having us.
It's great to have you both here. This is going to be a very interesting conversation. This is a topic that comes up all the time, contract documents. And so we're going to dive into that for a little bit about two specific documents that the AIA has recently released that you both are very familiar with, and we're going to talk about that. But before we do that, I want to introduce who you are and learn a little bit more about who you are as an architect and where you came from. Michael Bell is an architect based in New Orleans and is the founder of Bell Architecture. His firm specializes in full-service residential design with a particular emphasis on custom homes. At Tulane, Michael received his Master of Architecture in 1984 and a Juris Doctor in 1990. He is licensed to practice both architecture and law. And before founding his firm, Michael practiced law for 3 years, primarily in defense of architects. And in 2007, Michael was asked to serve as president of AIA New Orleans during that organization's restructuring to serve a more energized post-Katrina architectural profession. In 2009, Michael began service on AIA Documents Committee, which is tasked with writing the AIA contract documents that we all know and many of us are using for our practice. And he served on that committee as committee chairman in 2017 and 2018. So very familiar with AIA contract documents, how they're created, why they're created. And then Leonard Cady is a principal of Leonard Cady Architecture and Design in Art in New York. His firm's work includes residential, commercial, and retail projects in New York, Connecticut, nationally, and abroad in London, Paris, and Prague. Leonard currently serves as chair of the Residential Contract Documents Task Group, which recently published AIA A110 and B110, which is the custom residential documents that AIA now offers, which is what we're going to talk about today. And as a member of the Interiors Document Task Group, Leonard helped create and publish the suite of Interiors documents. And both Michael and Leonard are active in AIA National and both speak regularly on this topic of contract documents. So there are few people in this world who are more qualified to talk about this topic that we're going to talk about today, with residential architecture and custom homes and contract documents. So we're going to have that conversation in a little bit. But before we do that, Michael and Leonard, I want to know more about you. I'm curious, as an architect, how you became an architect. Who inspired you to become an architect? and share your origin story. How did you get from that point to where you are today? Michael, let's start with you.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, when I was small, about 6 years old, my father had an architect design and build a custom home. And I was, of course, fascinated watching that process and watching the drawings develop, the design develop. And as I got older, I gravitated in that direction, had a creative streak as well. And also had the, to put a personality or a face on it, I also had the opportunity when I was in high school to speak with Buster Curtis. And Buster Curtis was of Curtis and Davis, which was later absorbed by Dim Jim, but Buster Curtis is the design architect for the Superdome in New Orleans, which has proven its longevity to be a one of the big modernist icons, I think, in the U.S. But he had designed a 3,000 square foot home for my grandparents, and I grew up visiting that home, and appreciating, it's very much mid-century type of architecture, and appreciating what architects do through that and through watching my father go through the design process of building his own home. And so I was on that path and went to Tulane and worked in Dallas, Texas for 4 years. And in the mid-80s, things weren't going so well in the economy, and like a lot of folks in bad times, I went back to school and I went to law school, and I thought that construction litigation would be a really lucrative career, and it indeed was. But after spending much of my life designing and building things and constructing things, it was hard to be in a profession that is in some ways destructive. And after about 3 years, I found my way back to architecture. I walked out the door of the law firm and started my own little firm doing additions and renovations, and stayed with, I did a little bit of everything early on, but stayed with custom residential. And that at some point 20 years ago or so, I said, this is all I'm going to do. And I stayed with it. But I'll add that, as Mark said, I'm being an attorney, I've just stayed fascinated with how design and construction interrelate with law and contracts. And they found, after Katrina, we were in a lot of contact with AIA National, and they found me down there as an architect and lawyer and said, you'd be kind of a person that might enjoy the documents committee. And so I did, as you said, I joined the documents committee, and I think we all know we all are familiar with AIA contract documents, but over my 13 years there, it was sort of my mission to, I really wanted to get our AIA documents to address residential as much as they could. And we'll get into that, I think, but I rolled off, we had our last meeting this past week, and I rolled off the documents committee after 13 years. And
wow,
the subject of what we're going to talk about today leaves me with the best feeling, because my last thing I worked on with Leonard was to create documents that will serve me for the rest of my career as a custom residential architect.
Yeah, very, very needed. So thank you. Thank you for your service to the profession, for sure, both of you. All right. Thank you, Michael. Leonard, what's your story? How did you get started in this world of architecture?
Well, at an early age, I was exposed to art in my home, travel to cities like Paris, where I saw new and old buildings. And that made a great impression on me. I also was moved by more pastoral settings in which architecture featured prominently in dramatic landscapes. Seeing buildings like Habitat by architect Safty in Montreal and Buckminster Fuller's Dome in Montreal and other buildings with strong architectural image inspired me and made me excited about architecture. At the same time, I was also curious about how mechanical and biological things worked. I had plastic pull-apart models of hearts, kidneys, and stomach, which I marveled at when I received an electronic device like a tape recorder, a camera, or a movie camera. The first thing I did was reach for a screwdriver and took them apart and then assembled them before actually using them. Cameras were of greatest interest to me and became my eye on the world. I realized I could capture images of what I saw with artistic compositions of horizons and objects and light and shadow. And so photography became my touchstone and has followed me throughout my love of art and architecture and has been my quick means of capturing my mind's eye. If only we had iPhones back then, it would have been maybe a little easier. I discovered that I was really moved by great art and architecture, either in person or in books. I loved materials, assembly of things, especially mechanical. The wood and metal shop in middle school introduced me to industrial objects and their assemblies. Later in a summer job in an electrical contracting company, I learned to weld and assemble heavy industrial materials. I didn't realize I was on a path to architecture. A guidance counselor once told me that if I did not particularly enjoy math, architecture was not an option.
Those pesky guidance counselors have been defeating architectural profession with myths for many, many years.
Isn't it true?
I hear that all the time. That specific sentence that you just said comes up very often in origin stories.
As a backpacker, I set an ambitious agenda of museums and buildings I wanted to visit. Summer allowed me for long days to view buildings and walk cities with purpose. That time in my life consolidated my deep passion for art and buildings, which has never waned. I worked in architecture firms most summers in between school. And had some really eye-opening experiences. One firm I worked at had original Mies van der Rohe drawings because they were the architects of record for the TD Bank buildings.
Wow, that must have been a treat to be able to see them.
It was amazing. The rigor in those drawings was amazing. I aspired to that standard of drawing from that moment on. Having grown up with Barcelona chairs at home, I remember how perfect the steel joinery was and how curious I was about what it took to achieve that level of aesthetic perfection. That kind of aesthetic and technical rigor is something that I'm always conscious of. I studied Renaissance architecture in Italy in a study abroad architecture program. And after having received a professional degree in architecture from University of Toronto, I worked for a large commercial firm that at its height created expressive steel architecture and tensile-like structures at an impressive scale. I worked on just about every type of commercial building, including office buildings, hospitals, retail, shopping malls, and hotels. I next went to the GSD at Harvard for a master's of architecture, and then moved to New York to work at KPF. I loved KPF's high standard of design and construction. I then moved to Europe and began my entrepreneurial phase of architecture. I moved to Paris to work with a Japanese construction company on a hotel golf course resort outside of Paris. Following that, I prospected in Prague and was hired by Western companies to create office space in historical buildings. I had to quickly understand how to engage companies in a contractual form. My first client was a law firm, White & Case. I took an AIA contract and modified it for use there. The partners signed it without any questions or changes, and I was on my way. I was able to work within their law offices and learned a lot about contracts and law by osmosis. I hung out at night with lawyers. I learned about how social compacts in countries like Japan bind relationships, or how in Europe, countries have court systems that take too long to settle disputes. And lastly, I learned how American contracts are among the lengthiest and most often used models for business engagement. Fast forward through many projects with lots of construction administration in New York and other locations, brings us to the AIA documents. I have now been on the AIA Contract Documents Committee for 5 years and chair the residential task group that created a new family of residential documents with small firms in mind. I'm very excited about the benefits entrepreneurial small firms will have from the B110 custom residential document and the A110.
Yeah, these documents are very exciting for me. I'm a residential architect as well. AIA contracts have always sort of gotten in my way as a residential architect. We used them on and off for some projects early on. I lost several projects because of the AIA contract documents early on, because they scared clients away. And it inspired me to develop my own contract. So I hired an attorney. We developed our own contract and didn't use AIA contracts for a long time. And so when I heard that the AIA contract documents were being developed specifically for the work that I do, custom residential architecture, I was really excited about it as well. I want to talk about them and how they work. We're listening, you know, people who are listening right now, all small, not all, but the vast majority of our listeners are small firms. The vast majority of those small firms are residential architects. So you're talking to the people who these documents specifically are going to affect professionally. And so I want to dive into them so they understand how they are, how they work, why they were developed. I have a question before we dive into the documents themselves about how AIA contract documents are created. The committees that you are on or are on. How are those committees formed, and how do the documents actually happen, right? These documents were created essentially from scratch. How does that process work?
I'll be glad to talk about that. There is a committee of about 30 to 35 member architects who are really work on content with some staff attorneys, about five attorneys at AIA, as well as there's some outside legal counsel who are in the world of construction litigation and see these documents, how they're used in the real world. And all of those 30 to 35, typically it fluctuates, but those AIA members, some of them are also in the world of some work with owners, some work with contractors. Of course, a lot are with architectural firms. So we try to get a blend of the experiences to inform the content from not just architecture firms, but from owners and contractors as well. And we also have insurance counsel who bring to the table some of their experiences. And one of the reasons we involve more than just architects is because they really need to be fair and balanced to be an industry standard, assign risk where they belong, the party that can best take on that risk. If we're not fair and balanced, we're not going to sell too many, which, that's the pecuniary way to look at it. But it's also, we want to be of service to the industry and have good quality documents that all the different parties use. But the committee meets. The committee is a hardworking committee. I keep all my hours like any good business minded architect should. And so I went back, and when I became chair, I was sort of trying to figure out how many hours am I in for, and started looking a little bit harder at it at that point. But I estimated that even when I wasn't chair, I was putting in about 250 hours a year into this volunteer work.
Yeah.
And believe me, I get a lot out of it too. It just so informs our practice and keeps us out of trouble. And I think it's important that everybody have contracts be an integral part of it. But it's a lot of work, and the committee meets four times a year. Two usually in DC at AIA headquarters, two times a year at other locations to sort of make it a little easier for our members on the West Coast. And then in between, there are a lot of conference calls. We go over a lot of content, documents tend to be built on other documents that mm-hmm. came before, but they're constantly growing and expanding and adapting to the new way we practice and, you know, changing practice like sustainability and digital are things that have been woven into the documents recently. And so they're living and breathing and constantly being updated. And we really, those of us who are into this really enjoy working on it and trying to keep them relevant.
Yeah. So the documents, when you started with these specific documents, I'm assuming they were, you know, a lot of it was built on the small projects suite or the interior suite.
I'd like to give you a little background on it and rolling into that is that, we kind of, like you said, weren't using AIA.
Right.
Documents. And we've heard from residential practitioners, we'd heard that, you know, oh, they're too big and they're too long. And many years ago, AIA, just because there was such a clamoring for shorter documents, created these documents that were the B105, which changed its name in 2017, B104, those were the owner-architect agreements. There's also owner-contractor agreements. But they were really there because people wanted short. But you know, those of us who are looking at these documents, there's so much that's missing. You know,
you're
not covering the what ifs and the unanticipated things that can happen in a project. And so we started with a survey. You know, that's how you start trying to figure out what your audience needs. And we sent out a survey to SPP, SFX, and CRAN. You know, these are the knowledge groups that most of your listeners will know. And we got about 400 responses. And, you know, we asked questions like, you know, what types of agreements do you use? You know, what modifications do you make to AIA language? What are you using if you're not using AIA contracts? And took all that information. And essentially the conclusion was, you know, these B101 is sort of the flagship owner-architect agreement, and the A101-201 is the owner-contractor. And especially the owner-architect agreement was very well serving put it this way, if somebody's paying attention, they would think, yes, I should be using this. But there were some edits and that, you know, that could be made and for these agreements that would make them more fine-tuned to custom residential. And so we started off thinking that we have all these resources on AIA, and one of them is one type of resource are guides, where we talk about how you can edit. So for example, if you want a limitation of liability provision, there's a guide that'll tell you how to do that. We thought, well, we just need a guide to tell them how they should edit a B101 for custom residential, the flagship owner architect agreement. But as we got into it, we really shifted gears and just said, you know, we can really write this and put the onus on us to edit it rather than asking practitioners who are busy people, as we all know, to edit it themselves. And so we put together a task group, and there's a total of five documents that came out of this task group, and Leonard and I and Marika Snyder in Memphis, Tennessee, and Susan Van Bell of AIA worked on these for a couple of years, and we came up with these documents, and we can get into, you know, sort of how they differ from the B101. But the important point is that they're a little shorter than the B101, but they're not much shorter. And I can't emphasize enough that, you know, you want we all kind of at the minimum, a owner-architect agreement is, architect's going to do this, the owner's going to pay them that. And from there, there's so much more you can add on. And to not go a little lengthy is to do so at one's own risk. And, you know, that would, our business advice is to don't fly by the seat of the pants and, you know, wonder, well, what happens when the owner tries to, you know, for example, assign your contract to somebody else. You know, is that in your letter agreement that you've developed? what happens when the owner says, you know, I think I'm going to contract this out myself. All of a sudden you're, you know, wait, I'm supposed to be doing CA with a general contractor. And, you know, there's obviously, you know, who the burden falls on when the owner tries to contract it out themselves. There are all these eventualities that really need to be in there. And that creates some length. And we've tried to edit out things that are not pertinent to residential, and then maybe and customize a few things that are.
Let's take a break to thank our sponsors for their support of this episode. As architecture demand increases toward pre-pandemic levels and beyond, how are you and your architecture firm keeping up? RCAT is here to help. RCAT.com offers several free tools to help architecture and design firms like yours get work done faster. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find the right products for your projects, and download BIM, CAD, and specifications right there on the same page without needing to pay or register. It's free. RCAT.com also offers product videos, catalogs, green reports, product certification information, outline and short form specification generation, and so much more. Visit RCAT.com today. RCAT.com is your one-stop solution to help increase your productivity and get more projects done faster. That's RCAT.com, ARCAT.com. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses automatically, track your time for your whole team by project, and get organized with financial reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature in FreshBooks is the automated invoice reminders. I think sending invoices and getting paid is one of the biggest barriers to our success as entrepreneur architects. Who has the time? But if we don't send out the invoices, we don't get paid, right? FreshBooks makes it easy to send out your invoices and get paid fast, online, with a click of a button. And when your client doesn't pay you on time, FreshBooks will send them a friendly email reminder through a simple system that you control. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Go to entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. In the last few years, premium outdoor spaces have become a must-have architectural feature. And Infratech outdoor electric heating systems have become the brand of choice among leading architects. Infratech heaters provide energy-efficient ambient warmth that allows homeowners to live outdoors during cooler months. Clients love them because they can enjoy 100 more nights a year outside. Architects love them because of their unparalleled versatility. From heater capacities and colors to mounting options that can either seamlessly disappear or accentuate a space with beautiful decorative coverings. They're also the only comfort heat company to offer smart home integration and hands-free voice-activated control. For over 60 years, Infratech has made their products in the USA at competitive prices. They offer incredible design and live technical support at every stage of a job. A few years ago, I was visiting Sonoma Wine Country in California. It was during the autumn, so it was a bit cool when the sun dropped below the horizon. One evening, we joined a group of friends for dinner at one of the big wineries, and we ate outside on the veranda. That amazing Sonoma sun was setting behind the vineyard, so it was getting rather cool that evening, but we were very comfortable. In fact, the temperature was perfect for an outdoor meal during a cool Sonoma evening. I looked up and around to discover why that temperature was so comfortable and found, yes, you guessed it, an Infratech heater integrated with the design of the wood trellis above our table. All these years later, I know it was an Infratech heater because back at the studio, we were planning a large outdoor space for a client, and outdoor heating was part of that plan, and we ended up specifying 6 Infratech heaters for that project. Their amazing customer support team helped us specify the right units, and we had a very happy and comfortable client. InfraTech is specified at the most prestigious properties around the world. Learn why and sign up for a free consultation at infratech-usa.com/podcast. That's infratech-usa.com/podcast. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So how do these documents differ from the A101s?
Well, the,
go ahead, Leonard.
Can I jump in there? These documents work in a more streamlined way. The A101 is a paired set of documents. It uses the format of entering infill points on 101. And A201 is a very lengthy terms agreement sheet. And you have to bind those two together. And that comprises a much larger document, ultimately. And it's cumbersome. And it also requires architects, especially, you know, architects at our level, to learn the document. And there's almost too much to learn at times. It would be a lot easier if residential architects like us knew the documents and then would just offer architects the pared down appropriate version. And that's what we did. I want to just backtrack a little. When I joined the committee, one of the most exciting things for me was going into the archives, the basement of the AIA National, and seeing the original 101, B101, which is service agreement, and A101, which is the construction agreement, from 1888. These documents have been around for a long time. And our committee has been around for that amount of time as well. And we sit for 10 years at a time, we're many generations older now. And there's a knowledge and a wisdom that comes with these documents. And so we're conveying this to everyone, you know, who's listening in today, so that there's trust and confidence that this wisdom is for their better business understanding. It's nice for architects to just concentrate on design, but there is a back of house that really has to do with the infrastructure and the logic of contracts and other things. And I think let us take care of how the contracts work for you, edit a little, but we've got your back. And also for owners and for contractors, we are trying to come up with something that really will stand the test of time. And it has, you know, for 130 some odd years, because all the parties that are involved in these documents trust and have experienced their fair and balanced approach. I would like to also describe one more thing for the uninitiated. The B series are a series of documents that are service agreements between architect and owner. The A series are a series of agreements between owner and contractor. The architect is mentioned in the A series as an authoritative voice or party that's parallel to the process, but they're actually not in that document. It's really important that the order, the relationship of the three parties in a traditional design, bid, build order is understood. And these documents lay that out and organize it correctly. One could try to draft their own agreements. And we know that about 50% of residential architects have relied on letter agreements, which is they're skimpy, but they don't actually, they're not aware of the order and the relationship of these three parties to the work.
Yeah.
Mark, if I may follow up on that. And it has to do with a few of these things we're talking about, the length of the documents, and as Leonard's talking about, there's the owner-architect and owner-contract agreements, contractor agreements are paired together. For me, the biggest thing, the biggest reason to have written the B110, the owner-architect agreement for custom residential project, has more to do with the owner-contractor agreement for a custom residential project. And that is that although B101, I found it very useful, the flagship owner-architect agreement, I found it very useful in my custom residential practice. The thing, you know, I'll digress here a second, that I think that the length of the contracts scare architects more than they scare owners. And I think we sort of project that on the owners and say the owner's intimidated by this. But having said that, even I, when I, you know, have the winner B101 owner architect agreement for a custom residential project with a client, when it came time to sign that owner contractor agreement, I just sort of shirked at 50 pages of owner contractor agreement, which, as Leonard said, is the A201 general conditions. Is always paired with, if it's a stipulated sum, it's the A101 owner contract agreement. That's 50 pages. Meanwhile, just like there were shorter owner architect agreements, there were also available shorter owner contract agreements. And there was a document, it was used to be called the A107, but it's called the A104, and it's the abbreviated form of owner contract agreement. And it has the general conditions incorporated into the one document. So it's not this 50 pages. I think it's like 23 or 24. And it's I think for a custom residential project, which is especially in construction, it's not as complicated. It doesn't have to be as complicated as a commercial construction project. That's what sold me on, hey, let's write an owner architect agreement that links and is coordinated with the shorter owner contractor agreement, because that was just, it was just too much, even for me. And it wasn't just the pages, it was sort of, there's a lot of formalities in a commercial construction project, which sort of get glossed over in a residential construction project.
And often was a lot of pushback from residential contractors to refuse to sign that contract. They would all want their own contract, which typically ended up being a letter of agreement. And then the owner didn't want to have that argument, so they would sign that contract. And you, as an architect, can only influence as much as you can influence. Now you have a decent owner-architect agreement, but you have a terrible owner-contractor agreement. And so the fact that now we have a A110 that might be a little bit more... contractors would be happier to take a look at it, might be, you know, really beneficial to the architect being able to use the B110 to connect them.
That's right.
So are there any unique provisions within these documents that our listeners should be aware of?
Yes. One of the things that we talked a lot about was that in the main B101, engineering services are included as part of the fee. For smaller firms, this is a very hard thing to measure. Can you get an engineer on board at a certain price? What is that price? We talked about it and really determined that most residential architects prefer to separate that cost and have the owners pay for engineering services on an as-need basis, because sometimes it's just not necessary. And in other times, there are circumstances that are uncovered that need more engineering services. So from a purely logical point of view in terms of fees, that aspect is taken out of the contract, put as an added expense, and so we can more precisely determine fees and control outcome.
I'll add to that you know, the one of the challenges of writing a document is that more so in residential than in commercial, folks practice in different ways. And, you know, for example, we do layout, mechanical, electrical, plumbing, of course, but we don't hire an MEP engineer, and the owner doesn't. It's really mostly done design build in, right, in this market, even on the nicest homes. But a structural engineer, we fold that, the structural engineer is our consultant. And other folks will, you know, have the owner hire the structural engineer. Some people want an MEP engineer, and it's a little less consistently practiced as it is in the commercial world. And so by just making that as a supplemental service, which means that in the table in Article 4, before you sign the contract, you agree who's going to provide it. It pulls it out of where it used to just be a line in the beginning of the architect services article in B101 Article 3. It says, you know, the architect will provide the usual and customary structural, mechanical, electrical, and plumbing engineering services. And that was really not, it certainly wasn't how I practiced. And so I would just always strike MEP, and then I'd have to put somewhere else, I'd explain exactly what we were doing relative to MEP and how it was designed, built. So by just pulling that out and putting it in the supplemental services table, it allows for some flexibility with the way different people practice.
The other thing we took out and put on the side for supplemental is rebidding, because you know, we recognize that especially in residential, you have more uninitiated
clients. Yeah.
And they're learning a lot of things along the way. They're learning to read drawings. They're learning about the process for the very first time. And sometimes there could be budgetary things that they don't quite understand. And so we wanted to make sure that once a project went to bid, and all the work was put in, and you had, you know, a good, credible list of bidders, and the prices came back, a rebidding exercise, if it was contemplated by an owner, would be a service that was recognized in compensation. And so, because you can't just have a kind of endless bidding process, there are finite limits. There are limits to your capacity to absorb that time. And so that's also something that's typical of residential.
Yeah, and that happens often, and so many architects will just eat that cost. They don't want to upset the client, right? That expectation was not managed properly, and so that situation occurs. They just deal with it, and then there goes their fee. And so to have this in their contract, the expectation is managed because the owner has now read that contract, understands that that's what's going to happen if they rebid the project, and you have something to go back to as an architect and say, hey, we're happy to rebid that, but here's the contract. This is how this process is going to work.
Yeah, we often talk about distributing the risk to the party that's best able to manage that risk or absorb the risk. And so all parties enter into a relationship, and then it's just a matter of allocating fairly and in a balanced fashion cost, time, and all the things that happen. And I think in particular in residential, there are very strong relationships with clients, and so it's very hard to go back and say, hey, you know, that's extra time. You just try to absorb it, as you said, Mark, and you know, do the best you can. But that affects the bottom line, and it can be catastrophic if someone takes advantage in the wrong way.
Yeah, and that for me, that's one of the biggest reasons. Obviously, the reduced, you know, the protection that a contract provides an architect with risk, but the ability for an architect to be able to manage expectations throughout the project, right, throughout the process of creating architecture and during construction, when those situations occur, having a contract allows you to let that inexperienced client understand what that process is going to be like, and then be able to have a document to reference when those situations may occur, to be able to go back and reference that document. And everybody is on the same page because everybody read that document.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Mark, because very often, you know, we think of contracts as some kind of place to deal with disputes. But in fact, one, with the name residential, it gives both parties the confidence that this is the right document for the job.
Very important.
And two, it acts as a manual, a guide to how the process will go, what is the typical architectural standard for phases of service, how those phases of service take place, what each party can expect of each other. And even for, you know, more uninitiated architects, it can be a really good guideline. Okay, now I'm supposed to do this. This is what the profession does. And so it has a wonderful instructional or educational quality to it. And that should never be underestimated, because ultimately, these documents are references. You know, the idea of actually disputing them, that's a last resort. They're just wonderful guides of how to do practice well. You know, Michael spoke about this earlier, that clients are not surprised, or owners are not surprised by the length of documents, because they sign documents like this for their mortgages and for other loans. And when they buy a property, this is sort of standard. Of course, we should have a good guide for how the service of architecture is delivered.
Go ahead, Michael.
That is one of the phrases we use all the time, is that it is really a roadmap for the project. And it certainly can tell the owner what to expect, but our experience is it's just as much for the architect. You know, just one of the classic ones is that at the end of the schematic design development, and actually before schematic design begins, you're supposed to assess the owner's budget as an architect, and then at the end of SD, you say, I think it's going to cost this. And that's the owner's opportunity to object, or, you know, and talk about, well, we need to rework things. And you skip giving an estimate after schematic design and go right on through design development. And then the owner freaks out when, even after CDs or whenever it occurs, that the owner realizes what this is really going to cost. It's not pretty. And you can lose a lot of services that you can time and you put into it. And the other one is, well, what happens when it, another good example is, well, what happens when this project comes in way over budget? You know, you go to Article 6, and we kept that in this document. There's a whole process about cooperating, you know, who's responsible for what. The architect, rightly so, has some responsibility for blowing the budget. You know, if there's a process you can follow this, so this thing, these documents really are, you know, as Leonard said, an educational tool and a roadmap.
Yeah. They're not only risk management documents, they're project management documents.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah.
Very interesting.
The other thing that I think is built into these documents from the very beginning, the origins in 1888, is that they anticipate a linear process. You design at a schematic level, and then you pass through this milestone with everyone's approval, and you begin detailing. And you close the door to returning to the diagrammatic level. That story has been told. Everybody's turned over every stone and considered every option. And it's an important thing, because if an architect were to go to CDs, build out the CD drawing set, and then have the owner say, well, you know, I'd actually rather have my house look like a bridge now. What do we do? That's hard to swallow. So these documents help everyone understand a linear process that makes sense and that's business-wise.
Yeah.
They're good for both parties. I mean, they're protective of both, but one of the things I point to a lot is the amount of additional services, which we were rightly entitled to collect, that we have been able to collect because we can point to things in the document. For example, surveyor made a big error and we had to modify the whole building. Well, you know, the document says we're architect is entitled to rely on the owner's consultant's information. The one I talk about when we sign the document is, okay, look, I likely will not ever have to charge you additional services, but this is the one you need to watch out for. And it's that first one that says that, when an owner changes previously approved instructions upon which you've relied, you know, that's additional services. And so you, soon as they say, you know, we're into DD and something they want to do conflicts with what they approved in SD, I just say, look, you know, this is we have to charge you hourly services to get back on track. And there have been a lot of additional, when we presented it on this before, I give a ton of examples of this. Just looking back in my practice, there are a lot of examples of where it was just clear as day, this is additional services, so I could ask for it. Whereas if you have a lesser document that doesn't cover all the eventualities, you know, you reasonable people would probably agree that, yeah, the architect ought to be paid extra for that. That wasn't something that, you know, they could have anticipated. But it's a whole lot easier when you don't have to appeal to their reasonableness. And you can just say, look, it says right here, you know, when the contractor submits, you know, four submittals for the same thing, at some point I can start charging additional services. And you know, we're not perfect either. And I find that there's this sort of gray area in architectural practice, this sort of fuzzy situation where sometimes you feel like you didn't, you know, like maybe we as architects missed some things. And so it can make you cower a little bit from asking for additional services because they can say, well, you cost me this because you forgot to include such and such in the design. And so the more you follow this roadmap and structure things and you think like a business person about all of these details and what they mean, you know, the greater confidence you'll have. One is that mindset will have you doing things more properly, but number two, you know, when it's in your contract, you can make the claim, and we don't make a lot of profit margin in this business in general, and we need all the help we can get. And when we provide something that wasn't what was contemplated, we should be compensated for it.
Yeah,
and these documents help you do that.
Right, and so they're business management documents as well.
That's right.
Yeah, and so
like that.
it's that's a big piece, right? That's a big piece because architects do struggle financially, and it's often because they don't have the legal backing to be able to have the confidence to go back to a client and say, hey, you need to pay us for that, right? Every other service provider, doctors, lawyers, accountants have no problem with that. But architects often, you know, because of the type of people who become architects, have that fear of going back to a client and asking for that additional service. But when it's in a contract, it's very easy to go back and say, look, this is it, it's right here. This is, we're going to read this together. It's clear that we are owed that money. And so we can be more profitable architects, which makes us better architects, right? Because now we have more money to be able to become better architects, have more time to spend on designing better architecture.
That's right.
If
you look at Article 4 in that, you can go online and there are sample documents you can view, and you can see the text of these documents we're talking about at the AIA contract documents website. But if you look in Article 4, it talks about all the potential additional services. And if you start looking at those and thinking, you know, how much of this do I give away on the average project?
Right.
And here it says, use this document. Here it says, this is entitles you to extra compensation. You can help yourself a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
confidence in these documents is really important. The very idea that an architect would cower over some wording doesn't speak well of the relationship between the client and the architect. A client would like architects to be bold and do good design and not be fearful in their design process. And so it's just no way to be when you have this kind of upstairs, downstairs relationship from the get-go that interferes with your ability to be creative and do what you do best, which is the art of architecture.
Yeah. We'll have a link on the show notes to access to go take a look at the samples that are available. It's aiacontracts.org is the website. We'll have that link on the show notes. Before we wrap up, Leonard and Michael, I wanted to ask you, what is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow? Leonard, maybe you can start us off with that.
I think that keeping pace with technology and how deliverables are generated these days. So, you know, when I started, we were hand drawing. Then we went to computers, and there are so many generations of new delivery methods. So that's really important. I think that getting out in the world and networking with people and really understanding what your clients are thinking about and what they like and what they're looking for makes you a better architect. Because if you just stick to your own world and think in a bubble, you may not appreciate the sophistication and ideas that they bring to the table. And I think that's really important. So speaking many languages, speaking the language of, let's say, a surgeon who needs a surgical suite or someone running a big company that needs specialized office space and so on, knowing their language will help immensely in your practice perception.
What about you, Michael?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It would be a long list. You know, it's tough when you ask for one thing, but and you might not be surprised when, I guess it goes back to, what's the saying that when you're a carpenter or a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, I'm immersed in this and in contracts and what they've done and how they've made our firm financially successful. And, you know, so I really focus on sort of the business management side of this. And I think that, you know, it's contracts are one tool in your quiver towards your operation, you know, successful operations and business management. But I just think that, partly because I think they're underappreciated. But if you get a hold of your contracts and use ones that people have thought about, thoroughly through all the things that you might face in your practice, I think it's a huge leg up on getting to be a successful firm.
His name is Michael Bell and Leonard Cady. Bell Architecture is Michael's firm. Leonard Cady Architecture and Design is Leonard's firm. You can learn more about AIA contract documents at aiacontracts.org. Again, we'll have a link to that on the show notes. Michael and Leonard, thank you very much, not only for coming by here today and sharing your knowledge about AIA contract documents, but all your service to the profession. You've absolutely have dedicated yourself to making the profession better through these contract documents, which is important. You know, those are the type of things that we need to strengthen our profession, right? That to help our profession thrive. From a not only a practice, but from a financial point of view. And I appreciate your dedication and your service to the profession.
Thank you, Mark. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you both. Thanks for coming by and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast. If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. That's how Entree Architect will grow to serve thousands more architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors, Arcat, FreshBooks, and Infratech Comfort Heaters, for their support of this episode Links to our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership. Ready to edit business resources, live monthly business training for architects, a supportive architect community, and simple systems. Our new business system program developed for small firm entrepreneur architects just like you. It's all waiting for you right now at Entree Architect Academy membership, including AIA Continuing Education Learning Units. Come join me and hundreds of your entrepreneur architect peers. Visit entrearchitect.com/join to enroll today. Thank you for listening. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.